In the mountains of western Maryland, the fog appears often. It collects thickly in the treetops and suspends itself gently over clearings. This is especially true in the region surrounding Savage River State Forest. The peak of Big Savage Mountain sits just 300 feet shy of the highest point in the state. In these hills, the Eastern Continental Divide splits the Atlantic seaboard from the rest of the nation. These mountains are borderlands in more ways than one. In the narrow strip of the state that makes up Maryland's western panhandle, it's possible to drive from West Virginia through Maryland and into Pennsylvania in only 6 miles. All three states share steep, rocky cliffs and expansive forests that are unmistakably Appalachia. People often think of Maryland as a suburb of Washington, D.C., and in some sense they're right. Most of the state's population and politics revolve around its shared border with the capital, but Western Maryland is a different universe. Unlike the D.C. suburbs, this is deeply conservative territory. Many of the towns and small cities are decaying monuments to steel, mining, and railroad industries that once thrived in the region. Jobs are harder to come by now. As you approach Big Savage Mountain on Interstate 68, large road signs flash yellow lights to warn you of the drastically reduced visibility in the mists ahead. At first, the sensation of walking through these clouds feels almost ethereal. It's beautiful in some way, maybe even a little spellbinding. But as the vapor thickens and opacifies and familiar surroundings start disappearing, this disorientation sets in. The fog erases the world, leaves a blank canvas, and brings with it the sense of vulnerability to the unseen. Whatever the murk might be obscuring, beside you, behind you, or even right in front of you, nothing is visible, and whatever transpires within is known only to those who experience it. So when the fog finally lifts, its secrets have vanished with it. This is a story about one of those secrets. It's the tale of a late-night cliffside ritual, an unnatural death amidst inexplicable circumstances, and a trial unlike any we've seen. The events we're about to relate took place from 2017 to 2018. As this first episode goes out, less than a year has passed since the trial we're reporting on has concluded. Emotions are still raw, memories are still vivid. To the people affected by these terrible events, it's our sincerest hope that you find we've covered this story respectfully, but honestly. We're willing to interview and give a voice to any of you. Everyone you'll hear from in this podcast, watch these events unfold. From Chromatic Media, in the heart of Morgantown, West Virginia, this is Appalachian Mysteria, Season 2, Big Savage. I first read about this case in the Cumberland Times news articles leading up to the trial we're about to describe, there were two things that grabbed my attention. The first was the unusual set of circumstances surrounding the death of Alexander Stevens, but the events are also unique in a more fundamental way. Most true crime stories begin with a murder, then disentangle the facts from the mystery until a killer is found. In this series, we open with a death, but you'll have to decide for yourself whether there's been a murder at all. If you've heard Chromatic Media's previous Appalachian true crime podcast on the WVU co-ed murders, you've already met co-producer Sarah James McLaughlin, formerly Sarah Gibbons. She'll be joining us again for this story and our guide through the events leading up to the trial, the reporter who wrote those articles that first interested me in this case, Teresa McMinn.
I'm Teresa McMinn, and I am the digital editor at Cumberland Times News in Cumberland, Maryland.
Teresa remembers the exact date that Alexander Stevens was found dead for a very simple reason.
It was my birthday, and I had been planning to take that day off, but time got away, and I didn't get around to giving enough notice to do it. So I just remember it was my birthday, and I remember thinking, this is a significant event, and I'll always remember January 4th, this person was found dead locally. At that time, we didn't know who he was, or I don't think we even had an age. It's pretty frequent that hikers go missing for a while, but this is the first time anybody has been found dead that I know of.
2 days after Alex's body was found, authorities reassured the public that the park was safe, calling his death a, quote, isolated incident, but they refused to give any other details, citing ongoing investigation. The day after that, an AP reporter named David Deschneaux revealed the first details of the case. His short write-up on the AP Wire said that Alex's body had been found naked in Savage River State Park and that a female companion had emerged from the woods, also naked and hypothermic. Both of them, it said, had fallen off a cliff.
So at this point, they were calling it a companion.
For those of you who don't know the voice of co-producer Sarah, that's her.
Did you have any idea of, like, the situation at all?
We had no idea. We were so in the dark. And, you know, little tidbits like that are just enough to make you even more curious and wonder what happened and what's going on, but we didn't have anything.
The only thing authorities would say about the circumstances surrounding the incident was that Alex's body sustained, quote, obvious trauma. It wasn't until March 2nd, 2 months later, that the state divulged three important details to the public. First, both Alex and his 20-year-old female companion had fallen from a rocky outcropping in Savage River State Forest called High Rock. Second, the unnamed young woman who survived that night had been hospitalized for nearly a month and was cooperating with detectives. Third, Alexander Stevens had been found with his throat cut open. Teresa's paper, the Cumberland Times News, kept asking for more details, but were being given nothing.
We reached out to the Maryland State Police, and they wouldn't give any information. They kept giving us the same line over and over again. It's an ongoing investigation. We can't give any information on this. It wasn't until July that a colleague of mine, Mike Sawyers, got a tip that for the first time, this female companion was named.
Yeah, I'm Michael Sawyers. In early July is when I got the tip of a name.
Of course, Mike won't tell us who tipped him off, but the name of Alex's companion is now known throughout the region, Megan Schaefer. Unbeknownst to the two reporters at the time, Megan had been quietly identified almost 4 months earlier in legal proceedings.
I plugged that name into the Maryland Judiciary case search, Megan Schaefer, and up popped two files. One a criminal file, one a civil file.
This meant that there were two currently open judicial proceedings surrounding Megan Schaefer. Mike called Teresa and told her what he'd found. It's always tempting for journalists to publish newly discovered information immediately, and they briefly considered posting Megan's name that night.
But we decided, nah, nobody else is on this. No other media is on this. Let's wait until tomorrow morning, go to the courthouse, which was the Allegheny County Courthouse, just up the street from the newspaper.
As a reporter, Mike had gone into the courthouse to look at public records many times over his 40-year career. He was well acquainted with the courthouse staff, including the man who was handing over the two Megan Schaefer files. He says the guy wasn't usually communicative at all and just quietly handed over whatever he was asking for.
So when he handed these over to me, though, he went, here you go, and had like a oh wow look on his face and handed them to me. And I'm fairly certain we're the first two people to go and look at those files. And they've been sitting there, who knows, well, at least since May, probably.
And remember how informal they felt? Like, I recall in the civil file scene, there was a bank. It looked like it came right from the bank. It was an original bank receipt.
It wasn't even attached. It was just
loose. Yeah, it's just loose in the files. There were just loose handwritten notes.
Yeah. And boy, were they thick. And I took the criminal case file. Teresa took the civil file. Yeah, we were sitting on a bench in the hallway, which was the only place to sit, and we started going through these files, and we'd try not to interrupt each other because there was a lot of stuff to go through. But, I mean, I'm going through there, and I'll say, oh, my God. And then Teresa would see something, and she'd say, oh, wow. So we knew each of us had something going on here. We got done. I bet you they were there a couple hours. Mm-hmm. I felt like I was reading a script for a made-for-TV movie.
It was crazy.
It was a blockbuster, no doubt about it, because people have been wanting information about this story for months. They wanted more.
Teresa and Mike planned to write a major story on everything they had discovered the next day. But the public did not even know Megan's name yet, and there were some journalistic ethics to parse through before revealing it.
Generally, she was being considered a victim. In those cases, we do not report the victim's name. And Sawyers and I sat in my car after we read through these stacks and layers of papers of files in the courthouse and debated whether we should name her. We had a conference call in my car with our regional editor, and we discussed this, you know, were we doing something wrong if we named her? And we agreed, no, it was in a public document. It was fair game. We weren't going to accuse her of doing anything. We were just going to lay out the story. We had no reason to believe that she was a victim.
The file I went through was loaded with officers' narratives. Officers from the Natural Resource Police, officers from Garrett County Sheriff's Department, Maryland State Police. I read all through that stuff. Nowhere was there any indication she felt she was a victim. And she told that to police.
The Times News decided to publish nearly everything the two had learned about January 3rd and 4th, 2017. In the first two episodes of Big Savage, we're going to be looking at the two files that Teresa and Mike saw that day, the criminal and the civil, one at a time. Together, they form the foundation of the trial of Megan Schaefer that took place in March of 2018.
It was obviously one of the most memorable stories of 40 years at the Cumberland Times News for me.
Mike Sawyers can say this with full hindsight now. A few months after Megan's trial, he retired from the newspaper.
I'm very proud that that effort in July, that story, won a first place investigative journalism award with the Maryland Delaware DC Press Association. So that was kind of a nice...
That was really nice.
Nice thing.
Yeah, that was fantastic. Congratulations on that. It was good work.
Thank you.
Case file number one, criminal proceedings. The criminal case file documented the primary mystery, the circumstances surrounding the death of Alexander Stevens. In addition to all the paperwork that Teresa and Mike went over, we now have access to emergency audio recordings that took place that night and early morning in question. We'll start with this one.
Hello?
Hello. We currently are looking for two individuals, and we believe that they're lost somewhere in the, I guess around the Savage River Reservoir, right around the Savage River hiking trail.
This caller, who will become an important part of the story, was a friend of Alex named Stephen Moon. He's an instructor at Frostburg State University and says that he and Alex had been best friends since middle school. The whole ordeal actually began about 8 hours before Moon's call. Alex did not live with his parents. So on January 3rd, when Alex stopped by their house with Megan Schaefer in the passenger seat and took his parents' dog, it was definitely out of the ordinary.
Janet Stevens is on one of the 911 calls explaining to a natural resources police dispatcher that she and her husband had been away for the day at a hospital. And when they came home, their dog was missing. And her mother told her that Alex said he was going to take the dog for a walk, which was very uncommon. He never did stuff like that, his mom said. So she was concerned because by the time she and her husband got home, the dog was gone.
As the hours passed and the sky darkened, the Stevens family got very worried. That's when Stephen Moon got involved.
Can you give me a description of?
Yes, white male, black, longer hair, wears glasses, and he's probably about 5'10", 140, 150 pounds.
Okay, and is it only one person, or what's the other person's name?
There's another person, and this is a female, and she is white, and she's probably about 5 foot, and
she's a little bit heavier, and she's got blonde, dirty blonde hair.
The male's name?
Alexander Stevens.
And the lady's name?
Megan Schaefer.
It's 2 o'clock in the morning. You know, you hear the natural resources police dispatcher yawning, and she's trying to take down notes, and, you know, he's going through the description of Alex's height and weight and Megan's height and weight and their hair color and stuff like that. And he's saying, adding details as he goes and saying things like,
they also have animals with them. They have 2 ferrets and a Yorkie dog.
Okay, they have, wait a minute, 2 ferrets?
Correct.
Ferrets? And he describes more and more. So the more you hear about what he found up there, the more bizarre it is.
From these calls, we learn that Stephen Moon was the first person who discovered the site where Alex and Megan spent their last night together.
How did he know where to go?
We don't know how he knew where to go. And it's not like it's a location where he just happened to be driving by and saw their cars. I mean, this is an extremely remote, in the middle of nowhere place.
To get to the rocky ledge where Alex and Megan headed that night, you have to park along a rural road, cross the street past a closed gate, then hike a mile-long trail up 550 feet in elevation. At this point in the story, we don't know how Stephen Moon knew to look for Alex and Megan at High Rock, but we do know he found their cars by the trailhead.
Megan's car has the key in it to the auxiliary position. The dash lights are on. I believe the radio was on.
Was there anything else in the cars? Like, were there clothes there? Any kind of personal effects?
There was a cell phone on the back seat of what we believe was Megan's car at that time. He says that Alex's car appears to have some sort of flammable liquid all over it. I think he just describes it as a chemical.
To properly imagine this scene, you have to remember that the weather is hovering around freezing. It's been raining, and it's very difficult to see anything at all.
Yeah, it's extremely dark out there. I mean, there are you're not talking about a location where there are road lights or any kind of overhead lighting. It had to be extremely dark.
I mean, that's kind of a weird thing to say. Like, I came upon this car and there's a chemical all over it.
Well, yeah, sure, it's weird, but I mean, what's not weird about this entire case?
Stephen Moon hikes the mile through darkened forest to the High Rock Lookout. When he finally reaches the rocky outcropping at the end of the trail, Moon discovers a surreal scene. A small cage is sitting on the rocks. Inside of it, the black cat Alex had recently adopted from a shelter. There are burned candles nearby, and a bag of clothing, which is also seemingly covered in some chemical.
But yet there's no sign of Alex or Megan.
It's at this point that Stephen Moon drives back to Alex's parents' house and makes the 911 call we've been listening to. After getting off the phone with Moon, the officer who had taken his call dials a police lieutenant who will be responsible for initiating a search.
Morning.
Hey, this is Kitty calling from communications.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I know you don't want to hear from me. I know, I'm people's least favorite person. I got a call from a Mr. Stephen Moon. His friends, Alexander Stevens and Megan Schaefer, he believes they are lost near the fire tower at Savage River State Forest.
She's relaying all this bizarre information to this natural resources officer who, again, it's 2 o'clock in the morning. He's just apparently, she woke him. He's trying to get his thoughts together. He doesn't take notes initially. He has to go back and find a pen. And she's describing all these bizarre events, the ferrets and, you know, the location.
I'm going to call Mr. Moon, see if these guys are a couple or...
Okay.
Are they on a suicide walk?
Right.
That's the first time we ever have mention of suicide.
The lieutenant does call Stephen Moon and Alexander Stephen's family, who are all together, and asks them a number of clarifying questions. While this call may be one of the most important made that night, we do not have a recording of it, as it was presumably made on the lieutenant's personal phone. What we do know is that the lieutenant calls back the dispatcher minutes later to initiate the search for Alex and Megan. The first thing he says on that phone call sets off the mystery surrounding this case.
DNR Communications, PCO Witter speaking. May I help you?
So this guy thinks his friend and the girl may have committed suicide.
The other guy, Stephen Moon, thinks his friend and the girl may have committed suicide. But Moon is apparently not the only one who thinks so. While wrapping up the call, the lieutenant also seems to state that Alex's parents, Jay and Janet Stevens, also believe that Alex and Megan may have killed themselves together.
The family thinks it might be a possible suicide.
A search is organized, including two teams of officers and a K-9.
Hey, Lieutenant Muse, if you can come in service and head to Savage River State Forest. They're working... supposedly two people that were lost inside the park. However, it seems to be a possible suicide of both.
They begin at 7 a.m. as light begins to creep over the mountains. 1 hour into the search, Garrett County receives a 911 call from Megan Schaefer. She says she's been in the woods all night and broken into an empty house to find a phone. She's naked, injured, and hypothermic.
Hello, yeah, this is Sheriff's Office, Garrett County.
Uh-huh.
The missing people that you have down in Savage River?
Correct.
We have a small child on the phone stating that she's one of them that was lost overnight, and she is now at 2316 Pine Swamp Road.
Do you have her name?
Megan Schaefer.
Megan Schaefer is not a small child. She was 20 years old at the time. She is, however, a small person, standing about 5 feet tall with a higher-pitched voice. We think that this is the reason she was mistaken for a small child. But Megan's call is the only emergency recording that we were denied access to. The Garrett County attorney denied not only our request for the audio, but requests from Teresa's newspaper and the AP as well.
Allegheny County had no difficulty in handing over the audio. Natural Resources Police, same thing. They said, give me an address, I'll send you a CD. And they did. Garrett County absolutely refused to hand over the audio recordings. And while they say the transcript, which they were happy to email immediately, the full transcript, they say that is what's essentially on the 911 audio, they refuse to hand the audio over.
Did they give you a reason why?
The reason given by Garrett County for its denial is a little complicated, but the county attorney basically argues that providing the audio somehow violates the state's wiretap statute, which, according to every legal professional we've spoken to, is absurd. He also said that he has repeatedly informed people how to challenge the ruling, but no one ever has, so we decided to take him up on the offer. After looking over the case, the Society of Professional Journalists has provided Chromatic Media with the funds it needs to file a lawsuit against the county for Megan's phone call. Our court appearance has not happened yet. We'll let you know how the judge ruled in a later episode. In any case, in the 24 hours following Megan's phone call, it became clear that the situation was going to become a lot more complicated than strange rituals or lost hikers.
Now the young child that we're speaking with, she's stating that the other party, she believes, may be deceased. She's telling us that they fell off of a cliff.
Megan is able to communicate her location by finding a piece of mail on the way into the house. She makes her call from a cell phone, also found in the house, which had a safety feature that allowed the user to dial 911 without having to unlock the phone. She says that she is on a couch, in pain, and barely able to move. In fact, by the time an officer arrives, she is apparently unable to get up to let him in.
Okay. Yeah, we've got her on the phone trying to get her to open the door there.
Okay.
I believe he may be at the right house.
He's going to go back up and knock.
Okay. Yeah. She's stating that...
Back door and the side door locked. He's on check the front.
Can you check the front for me? She has the door locked. Okay. She can hear someone there, but she says she's unable to get up to get to... She's even saying that she can see an officer. He may need the force entry if...
Okay.
If,
all right, if he can't...
She's telling us that she can't get up to the door.
Okay, it sounds like he's in with her.
Meanwhile, officers are using the limited information provided by Megan to find Alex. They start next to the abandoned High Rock Fire Tower, where Stephen Moon found the cat, the candles, and the bag of clothing.
46871, we're right below the tower at the bottom of the cliffs. We're going to try to get up in there. The female subject advised once they fell, they started to walk, but really didn't know a direction of travel.
During this time period, we can hear that the strange events of the previous 12 hours have already begun to echo through conversations of authorities and rescue workers with each other.
Apparently she couldn't get to the door when we arrived at the house.
Did she fall off the cliff too?
Yeah, she fell off the cliff too.
Holy
heck. It must have both, it sounds weird. It sounds like they both walked off the cliff together. She survived the heat event and she decided to live.
And here's the same dispatcher talking about the case with a lieutenant who organized the search.
I got the call at 2:00 something in the morning, so I was dead.
Yeah.
So by the time I shook it off and actually called the complainant, and I'm talking to him, and I'm like, just saying to myself, something ain't right here.
Yeah.
And he was like, you know, the car still has the keys in it, and the radio's on, and the hood light is, I mean, the dome light is on, and her keys, and is. Something.
Crazy.
Phone is in the front seat, and a bag full of clothes.
Jeez.
Naked.
Oh, my God.
It's weird. I mean, then when he said, and I found their cat, I was like, what?
A helicopter is brought out to search the Savage River landscape. At roughly 9:30 a.m., Alex's body is located.
Aircraft has a visual on the subject. We're going to go down to him now.
He was found an unknown distance away from the base of the cliff at High Rock, naked, face down, a broken rib puncturing one of his lungs, throat slashed, a knife with a 7-inch blade lying near his head. Megan was transported to the hospital, where she stayed for nearly a month. The Stevens family dog was inexplicably found alive and well, caged, and in a cemetery nowhere near High Rock. The ferrets are still unaccounted for. We'll talk a little about the repercussions of Teresa and Mike's article in episode 2, but from the perspective of the public, not much happened with the case for months. It wasn't until September of 2017 that the state finally filed charges against Megan Schaefer.
She was charged with second-degree murder, manslaughter, and assisted suicide right after her 21st birthday, which was September 11th.
In one very important way, this made the case even more strange than it already was. The charges of murder and assisted suicide are mutually exclusive. In one scenario, Alex wanted to die, in the other, he didn't. This is not purely academic. The difference in motive, sentencing, and ethics between these charges is vast. I'm not sure if it's possible to figure out how often this happens, but I'd be willing to bet it's pretty rare. Megan Schaefer pled not guilty to all charges.
So Alex's body was found on January 4th, Megan wasn't charged with anything until September. Because we haven't seen the evidence and it took 8 months for the state to charge Megan with anything, I think they included this variety of charges just hoping that they had enough evidence to convict her on something. There are so many variables and so very many ways this whole thing could go, and I don't have any sense at this point of how the state is going to present their case and what are they going to argue first? What are they going to go after first? Will there be a first? Will they just say, let's start arguing on the murder charge, and then if we don't feel we're swaying the jury, then we'll start focusing more heavily on the suicide.
Convincing a jury that someone is guilty of a crime like this is rarely a simple matter of fact-finding. It's the job of the prosecution to tell a story that makes sense to the jurors. I told Teresa that if I was on a jury, and it looked like the prosecution was just hoping I'd believe either of two very different stories, it would feel like they were aiming for a long shot.
I think long shot is a very important word in this whole scenario. Again, it took the state 8 months to even charge her with anything. Why did it take that long? Is it because they didn't have enough evidence? She and her parents only had to basically give a promise that they would provide $100,000 in the event she skips town. No money was transacted.
Not even 10%.
Not even 10%. That seems highly unusual.
If this was homicide, why all the rituals of finality, like the collection of pets and personal items? Why try to kill someone in such a way that you end up naked, injured, and hypothermic? Why do those closest to Alex suggest it's a suicide to police? But a double suicide attempt makes no sense either. How do two people jumping to their deaths end up with a knife at the bottom of a cliff? And perhaps more importantly, why did Megan's story about these events change? We get into those details in future episodes. Next time on Appalachian Mysteria, the second case file discovered by Teresa and Mike adds a new layer of confusion and speculation. Public backlash begins against Teresa's reporting of the case. We try to figure out who Alex and Megan really were. And we talk about the most important questions we wanted to find answers to during the trial. We recorded the first two episodes of this podcast before the March 2018 trial of Megan Schaefer. Between Teresa and reporters with Chromatic Media, we witnessed the whole ordeal. This, of course, means that the information about how the trial ended is already publicly available, but we encourage you to resist the urge to look it up, stick out the podcast with us. From episode 3 on, we delve into total coverage of the trial of Megan Schaefer in an attempt to understand a story that seems to defy rational explanation at every turn. Appalachian Mysteria is a Chromatic Media production. It was produced by myself and Sarah James McLaughlin with lots of assistance from our co-host, Teresa McMinn, and courtroom reporting by Jordan Carter. If you find yourself liking the show, take 2 seconds to rate it on your podcasting service. It makes a difference in helping others to find good stuff. If you haven't listened to season 1 of Appalachian Mysteria about the WVU co-ed murders, make sure to check that out as well. You can connect with us and others about the case and view updates as any become available at the Big Savage Facebook page. You can follow Chromatic Media on Facebook and Instagram as well. The music for this show was written and recorded in Morgantown, West Virginia by John Smithers, Nick Larson, Annie Stroud, and Nathan Snyder. The track you're hearing right now was written by an extremely talented young Morgantown artist named Annalise Steele. I heard her performing this particular song at a local show, and it made me think of this story. Our music team convinced her to record a studio version for you. Thanks to Mark Poole and Shannon Bean for helping with that. Stay tuned, the story just gets crazier.
Did you think it was okay when you wilted, ran and died and threw down the place? Is there a way I can go now? A way I can show you? Scared of the world before I saw with you. I was cautious and daunted. It would be haunting your lips. edge of an era, one where I wanna stay, but then I saw your face. Did you think I'd get up, go with you and prove again that I'm not enough? I didn't walk alone midnight before you. I was scared of the world before I saw with you. I was cautious and daunted, would be haunted. For you. My voice can't save me, tears are harmonies. My words don't mean anything, gasps or sonnets. Piano can't cut me, knives are a symphony. Silence won't kill me. You are a melody. You are a million melodies. We are dissonant and I am an elegy. I didn't walk alone at night before you. I was scared of the world before I saw with you. I was cautious. For you.